I'm Jessica Harris. This is From Scratch. My guest is Bob Moore, founder of Bob's Red Mill Natural Foods, a company that sells whole grain flours, cereals, and bread products to natural food stores across the United States. Bob started the company in 1978 after working as an auto mechanic owning gas stations for the first part of his professional life. When Bob turned 81 years old in 2010, he turned the company over to his over 200 employees through an ESOP, which is an employee stock ownership plan. The company is based in Portland, Oregon. I'm in New York City speaking to Bob, who's recording from Oregon Public Broadcasting. Welcome, Bob.
Well, thank you, Jessica. I'm very pleased to be here.
You grew up in Los Angeles, California in the 1930s. What did your parents do?
Well, my father actually in the 1930s was a Hostess cake and Wonder Bread dealer at the time. And then he went into a dressograph business with his father. They did extensive printing and mailing. One of the big accounts was MGM, Metro-Goldwyn-Mayer, and I have fond memories of these publications that were sent out monthly to all the theaters in the United States and the world. I would go down and help them what we called stuff, which means that you took the magazine and put it in an envelope, and I got pretty fast at it.
So there was some entrepreneurial blood in your family to begin with, but there was also some baking blood, your father having worked for the Hostess Cupcake Company?
Yeah, it's kind of funny when I think back at what I'm in, because they really weren't very whole grain. And even in those days, my folks would kid about the, like a loaf of Wonder Bread, you could take it and stuff it into a little round ball. There wasn't much to it.
When did you first encounter whole grains?
Well, we had a dairy goat farm, and I know you have dairy goats, so we have a little something in common. But my wife ran across books by Adele Davis and Gaylord Houser. Rodell had his dictionary of health foods. Those were early kind of pioneers in whole grains and better way of life. Mm-hmm. And Charlie, my wife, began feeding us as a family. We have three boys. And with a little farm, she really piqued my interest in whole grains, baking bread, making great cookies out of whole wheat flour. And we discovered health food stores. There was two in Sacramento where we lived. Going into the health food stores and smelling the whole grains. And the whole thing was just kind of a neat experience, something I had not had the slightest notion of before she introduced those things to me.
Now, a lot happened between Wonder Bread and Charlie, your wife, introducing you to these whole grains and you're discovering it together. So I want to step back a little bit. How did you meet your wife, Charlie?
I spent 3 years in the Army, and with the 3 years from the Army, I went to school in electrical engineering, and I worked at a company called U.S. Electrical Motors. And Charlie, my wife, was one of the day workers, and because her name was Charlie, C-H-A-R-L-E-E, they all called her Chuck. And there's always a certain curiosity, you know, especially when you're single. Well, I wonder what a girl named Chuck looks like. Well, we courted for a while and got married, and we've had a wonderful marriage. If I had it to do over, I'd do exactly the same thing again.
Oh, you mentioned that you and Charlie worked at the U.S. Electrical Motors in the 1950s. What did you do specifically for them?
They sent me out traveling, doing work in the field. My job was to troubleshoot and try to correct things. So it was a pretty responsible job, but it also required me to travel a lot. And we were having children at this time. And all in all, after about 5 years, I just simply felt that I didn't want to keep doing this. And one other thing I might say, Jessica, was my father passed away, and he and I were so close. He was a heavy smoker. I haven't got a whole lot of use for tobacco, and partly because I lost my dad at 49. So it inspired me to want to go into business because Dad and I had always talked about going into something together. But when he passed away, it just really shocked me that I lost this wonderful friend.
So upon your father's passing away, you actually had a first foray into an entrepreneurial life where you bought a service station, a mobile station that was for sale.
It was a brand new mobile station, and I guess I think the way I got started was there was a sign on the property, coming soon, a brand new mobile station, and then a phone number about the need for dealers, and I made a phone call, and I don't know, Jessica. That's been a long time ago. I was about 25, and things went pretty fast. We put our GI home up for sale and sold it right away and got enough money to satisfy the mobile company that I could have this gas station. The joy of being in business for yourself, even though I worked, like the first year I worked 365 days. I opened every morning, closed every night. Mm-hmm. So I got a taste of hard work and staying with things. And Charlie, bless her heart, she stayed right with me, helped me with certain things, paperwork and stuff. And we had three boys by that time.
You capitalized the gas station with the returns from selling your house for $4,500.
It's about right.
How successful was the mobile station that you ran in L.A.?
Very comfortably successful. But I have to tell you that living in Los Angeles, which is where all this happened, and with the boys and all, there was an underlying unhappiness about Los Angeles. The smog in the 50s was really something. And it just kind of bugged us. So we spent a little time looking about, since I had a gas station, and I thought, well, heck, I can make a living anywhere with a gas station, wherever there is one. So we sold the station, and we sold our nice home and moved up to Mammoth Lakes, California, and we moved into a trailer, mobile home, I guess we called them, with the family and all. It's an interesting change in life. The whole year of 1960, was a very strange weather year, and the gas station business just was not good. And I just proceeded over a period of 12 months to expend all the money I had. And unfortunately, I went broke.
What did you think about doing? You went broke. You had three children. What was your mental state at the time?
I have a pretty good mental state, period, even today. And what I actually did was I drove down to Sacramento, California, and I got a job at the dealer of U.S. Electrical Motors. Mm-hmm. So, you know, it was a matter of getting back on our feet again. So we moved the trailer to Sacramento, and I wasn't in business for myself anymore. I was working for somebody else.
I'm Jessica Harris, and you're listening to From Scratch. My guest is Bob Moore, founder of Bob's Red Mill, a company that produces whole grain products, including cornmeal, barley, and whole wheat flour. Bob started the company in 1978. Along the way, you discovered a book called John Goffey's Mill by George Woodberry, which is a book about milling in the 1700s. How did that pique your interest?
It's an autobiography of a portion of his life. He inherited this mill, John Goffey's mill, in Bedford, New Hampshire. And the mill was a derelict. He went to the mill to discover what he had. And this whole book is about his life and his experiences restoring the mill. It was water-powered, stone mill, grinding corn, grinding wheat. And actually, the story that he tells was so wonderful the historical aspects of it and having people come, and the successfulness of it was another thing. That I'm an entrepreneur. I like to think that way, and he obviously was too. But it was the historicity of the whole thing. I mean, he was dealing with millstones that were a couple hundred years old. The book was written about 1950. So it wasn't all that old when I picked it up. And I was just, I think, maybe the only person in the world that was just so fascinated with a book that it basically had to change my life.
Mm. Now, at what point did you discover the book?
When we moved to Sacramento after we went broke up in the mountains, we were able to get this dairy goat farm. Mm. And during that time, my wife got us interested in whole grains. And it was later when we actually moved to Redding, California, and it was there that this book, John Goffey's Mill, was in the library. And I just picked it up. It actually was set there on the library table. Someone hadn't put it away. So I've always felt kind of a providential sense about this, because that book is really the fundamental change in my life. It gave me purpose. Mm-hmm. First off, George Woodbury didn't know anything about milling, mm-hmm. but he took on this because he owned it and he was successful. And I thought, you know, if he can do this, I can do it.
There's connective tissue between the auto engineering and the engineering behind grinding technologies, but I feel like that's kind of where the similarities stop, because in a way you were dealing with cars and things that were very much man-made and industrial on the one hand, but here this milling of things from the earth was kind of on the opposite end of the spectrum, using soils and the natural life to produce things. Did that at all occur to you at the time?
Yes. Making your living with whole grains, which are as close to the earth as you can get, has a great appeal to me. And it's totally opposite the automotive end of things, the mechanics and everything else. And I guess really the automobile today, unless we turn to electricity, is still kind of a polluter of everything. It is a polluter of everything. And I felt very strongly about the health aspects of whole grains. And yeah, it was a change for me.
I'm Jessica Harris. You're listening to From Scratch. My guest is Bob Moore, founder of Bob's Red Mill Natural Foods. We'll hear more from Bob coming up. I'm Jessica Harris. This is From Scratch. My guest is Bob Moore, founder of Bob's Red Mill Natural Foods, a company that sells whole grain flours, cereals, and bread products to natural food stores across the United States. Bob started the company in 1978 after working as an auto mechanic, owning gas stations for the first part of his professional life. When Bob turned 81 years old in 2010, he turned the company over to his over 200 employees through an ESOP, which is an employee stock ownership plan. I'm in New York City speaking with Bob, who is in Portland, Oregon. Upon reading the book, you decided to start a company with your three children in California. It was sort of the predecessor for the current company. Can you talk a little bit about that experience?
Sure. I think right as soon as I finished John Goffey's Mill, I took, still in the library, books on American manufacturing. I looked up flour milling, grinding, all kinds of things, and I wrote a bunch of letters to the companies in the United States that I thought could help me get some equipment, and I got a response from just one, and he put me in touch with an old gentleman that had a mill, and things just began to take shape. His name was Dewey Sheets, a charming old gentleman. Dewey told me about a mill in Fayetteville, North Carolina that had all the stone grinding equipment in it and stuff that he thought I would need. Through Dewey, I was able to get several stone mills. in bucket elevators and grain cleaners and different things that would be necessary to go into this new idea and new way of life for us. The boys were just wonderful helping to get all this going. I was kind of the driving force, but they read the books. I can't really believe how well we did. It was very successful. The media came out, TV people or newspaper, this crazy little business, and we had it set up so that people could look through a large window at these stone mills that we had acquired, and we would grind custom cornmeal, barley, whole wheat flour, all kinds of the whole grains, and we were learning. Our customer base was Redding, California, about 18,000 people. So, you know, there was definite limitations to what our little company could do in Redding because of the small population.
Yet despite this success, you decide to move to Oregon and go to seminary and learn the Bible. What was the process behind, you know, leaving this business and saying to your wife and kids, you know what, I want to move to Portland and learn the Bible, and not just learn the Bible in English, but learn it in Hebrew and Greek?
Well, I've had wonderful religious experiences in my life, and I am a Christian. I have great respect for the Bible and felt that I wanted to learn more about it. And Portland has about four seminaries. And so we came up here on a little vacation and inquired as to whether we could take courses, and I was successful. The Western Evangelical Seminary, which is now not here, but they were willing to take Charlie and I on with these courses. They had some great scholars there. So we sold the house. The business I just more or less gave to the boys, and then we moved on to Portland, Oregon.
It seems like your life has been, you know, quite nomadic and very much filled with exploration and adventure to some degree. Whereas, in contrast, you know, people's lives tends to have, at least these days, a stickiness to it. How you could just, you know, pick up and go from California to Oregon and leave the milling business that you had started with your children to then you just go to seminary.
Well, I think you're causing me to think about myself here a little bit, Jessica. The nomadic thing, I guess. I guess I was a little nomadic. Everything seemed to have a good purpose to it. I'm reviewing in my mind. Here, my wife and I, our children are grown, and we've always gotten along very well. And I thought it'd be kind of cool. Moving up to Portland, just the two of us, it was like a honeymoon in a way. I mean, I thought it was time to let the boys figure things out for themselves. They're still in the business. So when we moved to Portland here, we enjoyed it. I think of the first 6 months, 8 months of being in Portland and going to school was one of the most wonderful times of our life.
And then in 1978, while you're at seminary, you decided to start a chapter two of your life, which was then to build Bob's Red Mill. How did that happen? What was the turning point for that?
Well, we were in school, and we did a ton of walking, with vocabulary cards, Greek nouns and verbs and things, and trying to memorize them so we could learn the language and whatnot. And after we'd been here for several months, we walked down a certain street, and here was an old flour mill. I could not believe my eyes. So I walked over and looked in, and I can still remember my wife saying, "Well, what are you doing?" And I said, "Well, I just want to look at it." But, you know, there was a phone number, and it was vacant. And I said, "Well, I'm just going to call." She said, "Well, you know, I thought we were going to go to school." Well, we were. And I said, "Well, just let me just make a phone call." And but it just kind of boiled down to the property was available. It had a lot of the equipment that I needed to start another mill. It had bucket elevators and different things. And guess what? I got a hold of Dewey Sheets, my original mentor, and he had a mill that he could get for me. And the thing went together so rapidly that it was almost like a dream.
And you mentioned before a providential sense when you found the John Goff's Mill book in the library. To what extent did you think Providence played a role in your finding this mill by happenstance in Portland?
Well, I have to say, that's my take on it. Jessica, I have this sense of walking in a glow of some kind, and it seems to play a part in my life. I think I have been guided by these things, and the way they happened is so unusual. The old mill, the reason the mill quit working, there used to be a rail line alongside of it, and they tore the rail line out in 1957. So the building was really just derelict, but we brought our grains in by truck. But the original owners, I guess, thought that the rail was the only way to do it.
You've had a charmed life to some extent. You just walk into this mill and you find the proper equipment and everything just works beautifully. And one of your allies in this whole process is the media in Oregon. Can you talk to me a little bit about that?
I don't think we'd been open 2 weeks when, Kathy Smith. She was a news person on our local ABC, and she was out with a camera. I couldn't believe it. And, you know, after that went on the evening news, people just flocked to the mill. It was just astounding. I have to say that the media in Portland was just unbelievably good to Bob's Red Mill, Jessica. We had several programs that like to come out, television programs, and they just love to come out and start their show from this old mill. In our local newspapers, the Oregonian, of course, just on a steady, regular basis, I have had the most wonderful response from the media, and I don't know what I could have done without them. It was incredible.
And when you were thinking about launching the business and thinking about all the logistics involved, how much did you think about, PR and the role that media is going to play in my success?
I don't think I thought of anything about that. I just thought the mill was clever enough. If you see any pictures of it, it was we eventually painted it red. In the very beginning, it was so unique, and I'm a great believer in advertising. I put small ads in the Oregonian and in our local newspaper. So I actually helped myself to some degree make it work. I didn't just sit back and kind of helpless about the whole thing. But the kind of advertising that I put in the paper, advertising my whole grain flour, whole wheat cornmeal, things like that, those were successful ads. But I don't think anything was as successful. When the evening news had this little thing on the entrepreneurials of Portland.
Incidentally, we talk about how successful the business was really at the inception, in part because the media was so friendly to you. What were some of the challenges that you faced in the early days?
Challenges. Let's see. Well, I don't know, Jessica, whether I really look back on that era of times, about 10 years that we had the mill before our disastrous arson fire burned it to the ground. But taking into consideration the 10 years from 1978 to 1988, those were some of the best years of my life. I guess the real challenge was trying to keep up with business. I think even today my challenge is the growth of the company.
You started a retail operation initially in Oregon with roughly 7 employees. What then was responsible for the business becoming a wholesale business and jumping to eventually 200-plus employees?
actually, some of the local grocery chains, well, Safeway is not local, but their local warehouses and stuff wanted some of our products. They wanted to carry whole grain products. And the biggest was Fred Meyer. They were a local company that had stores in the Northwest. They had about 44 stores, and they were opening nutrition centers, health food stores, if you will, as a part of their grocery stores. That was about 1978, just about the time I started. Those people came to me and they wanted my products, and I laughed at them. My retail business was pretty good, and my wife and I were not having any problem making our bills. We had, I'm going to guess about 7 people by that time. Mm-hmm. And I finally decided that I would give it a try. So across the street from where the mill was a vacant building. It was about 20,000 square feet, and we rented that for warehouse and other needs that we had, and began the process, adding people, the challenge of new packaging, new lines, everything.
So how did you go about funding the business?
Well, I had a great rapport with U.S. Bank. Bruce Cullison was the bank manager of the local U.S. Bank in Oregon City. And Bruce and I, he just really believed in what I was doing. Mm-hmm. And back in the 70s, bank managers had a lot more autonomy with their loans and different things. And Bruce really believed in what I was doing. He and his wife would come to the mill and buy things. And so he made it pretty easy for me to borrow money. Let's say borrowing money at that time would be like $50,000.
By the way, who supplied you with all this cornmeal and barley and whole wheat flour, et cetera?
Well, I think that we've created like corn and wheat. Those particular grains, we are still dealing with the same people we were dealing with when we first started in Davis, California. There's a large 6,000 acre farm there. The Gill, we call them the Gill boys, father and son actually, and we're still buying our corn from them even after almost 40 years.
I'm Jessica Harris, and you're listening to From Scratch. My guest is Bob Moore, founder of Bob's Red Mill, a company that produces whole grain products, including cornmeal, barley, and whole wheat flour. In 1988, the mill was destroyed one night by a fire by a woman who set fire to the mill. Was there any thought in your mind that, you know what, this is a sign that I'm finished after 10 years of this solid growth? Or did you just say, you know what, I'm going to pick up where I left off and start over?
You're just numb by the whole thing. I mean, you're called at 12:30 at night, and I was only a mile and a half from the mill. And as soon as I got my car out of the garage and started down the street, I could hear sirens. And when I turned the corner, I could see the glow. So in the horizon, that I was pretty aware of what it was. And those kind of feelings you have they're kind of numbing. A few minutes later, my wife came down, and even one of the firemen, the volunteer fireman, was an employee of my company. So, you know, we were kind of a community effort here. By that time, we had 20 or 22 employees. One of my oldest employee, who is still with me today, he and his wife had just signed the papers for a new home that morning, and of course, there were other people that had depended on me, had been working for me for 10 years. So there's a certain responsibility that you feel when these people have dedicated their lives to the same cause that you're dedicated to. There was a certain reality, too, and that is that everything that I had financially was tied up in the business. Plus, I got my insurance check from the insurance company. I took it to the bank, to Bruce Cullison, my dear banker, and he said, do you want me to deposit this in your bank account? And I said, well, Bruce, that's your money, because after all, we have the loan. And he said, well, you're going to stay in business, aren't you? And all my people stuck with me. Fred Meyer, at that time my biggest customer, although we had Safeway and Albertsons and different others, they were good enough to put signs up in the sections where our product was about the mill. The product would be slow coming. We had that 20,000 square feet across the street. We moved into that as tight as we could. And here's my son Bob in Redding, California. One of my millers moved down with Bob for 3 months, and Dean would work all night milling stuff for us, and then be ready for Bob to take over and mill stuff for himself during the day. There just seemed to be so many people that were rooting for us. Within about 3 months, we found a 50,000 square foot location, just a couple of miles from the mill. All of these different circumstances, I was almost 60, so, how many people would hire me? I gave it some thought.
By the way, I'm sitting here in New York and you're in Oregon, and while you're in your 80s, you sound like you're in your 30s. how do you stay so healthy and sharp?
Well, now you're going to expect me to say I eat whole grains every day. and Jessica, I do eat whole grains. My wife's a great cook, and we've made whole grains a basic part of our life. You know, I'm very active, very, very active. I walk a lot. My cholesterol is 121. I eat flaxseed meal. I have oatmeal for breakfast, and I'm reasonably careful.
But, Bob, you can't hide the fact that you did have your share of Hostess baked items when you were a child.
I think so. Yes, I did. Yeah.
Well, Bob, thank you very much for joining us.
Oh, you bet, Jessica.
My guest has been Bob Moore, founder of Bob's Red Mill. Coming up, we'll hear from Michael and Rick Mast, founders of Mast Brothers Chocolate. I'm Jessica Harris, and this is From Scratch. I'm Jessica Harris. This is From Scratch. My guests are Elizabeth Cutler and Julie Rice, co-founders of SoulCycle, a company that offers indoor cycling classes through the New York metro region, Long Island, and Los Angeles. Elizabeth and Julie opened their first studio in 2006 on the Upper West Side of Manhattan, and the company has grown rapidly in popularity, attracting clients like Chelsea Clinton, Conan O'Brien, Katie Couric, and Kelly Ripa. SoulCycle classes are 45 minutes long and claim to be a full-body workout. Welcome.
Thank you. Hi. For having us.
So you are both unlikely people to start an exercise company. Tell me a little bit about your background. Why don't we start with you, Elizabeth?
I grew up in Chicago. I was not one of those kids who was really into sports. And I lived in Colorado for 14 years. And when I was living in Colorado, I got into hiking in particular, which is a great form of cardio. And when I moved back to New York, I met my husband, and I did yoga also. And I continued to do that. And after our children were born, I put on a lot of weight when I was pregnant. And my mother, who I adore, told me, don't worry about what you eat. I wore my jeans home from the hospital. And sadly enough, that was not my experience whatsoever. And about 6 weeks after our first daughter was born, I still had 45 pounds to go. And one of my dearest friends just said to me, you have got to get some cardio. And I was so intimidated. I was afraid. And I went to take a class. And a light really went off for me. I really felt like if I could access this, then so many people who feel like they can't do cardio could access this, and it could really change something for them, because everybody needs cardio and most people hate it.
Now, this was an indoor cycling class. Can you explain what a spin class or an indoor cycling class is for those who have never taken one?
At SoulCycle, we ride on indoor cycling bikes, and we have pedals that people use specific bike shoes to clip into. And what's great about that is that you're using your entire leg. But so basically what it is it's riding inside on a stationary bike in a class that's set to music and led by a teacher.
Elizabeth, you sold real estate in Colorado when you were living there.
I was. I had grown up in a real estate family. My mother was a very successful real estate broker in Chicago, and I ended up moving to Telluride. And while I was there, I got introduced to an arm of Oriental medicine called Jinshin Jitsu. So because of the lifestyle that exists in Colorado, I was able to do both, but just wasn't really the money that I would need to sort of live my life.
So you moved to New York City and you discovered indoor cycling. At what point did you say, you know what, this would be an interesting business to start?
You know, my sister-in-law owns Bikram Yoga, is a co-owner of Bikram Yoga here in the city. And so she was, I said to her, you know, I'm feeling this urge to do this. I mean, I had a five-month-old and a three-year-old. And she was really encouraging.
And how about you, Julie? You were a talent manager in Los Angeles.
I was in L.A. for about 9 years. And not unlike Elizabeth, I sort of had, you know, an aha moment on a bike. I've always been sort of athletic, but it's never really had a joyful effect on me before. I thought to myself, I get it. I understand why this can be something that's not just, you know, checking off, you know, exercise today on my to-do list.
What's an example of the impact that SoulCycle has had, not necessarily just physically?
Our experience now over and over again is people coming up to us and saying, you know, I don't go to my therapist anymore because I do it on the bike. Or I literally walked into the Upper East Side studio the other day and a woman came up to me and she said, I want you to know that you saved my life. She said, I just had a baby and I started working out here right after, you know, my child was born and you really saved my life. And I said to her, I'm so glad to hear it. You look amazing. How old is your child? And she said, oh, my baby is 5 months old, but that's not at all what I'm talking about. She explained that it really helped her connect to her child and back to herself and to her family. For us, the surprise gift in this business has been the emotional release that it has given to people.
When you noticed the benefits of doing a spin class, why did you necessarily say, well, I'd like to start a business? Where did that come from?
Truth be told, I sort of looked high and low for an experience that would make me feel like what I had found in my, you know, little indoor cycling studio in Los Angeles. I tried every indoor cycling class in New York City, and I just could not find it.
Was there also some unhappiness with your current work environment that kind of gave you the extra push to say, you know what, I'd like something new?
Definitely. Well, one thing that Elizabeth and I have very much in common were we both started the business when we had babies that were 5 months old. After I had my daughter, I definitely was feeling like I would like to figure out a job where I could work on my own terms.
So you both had this idea in isolation. How did you ultimately meet each other?
We met at a lunch. We were introduced and we started to talk.
By a mutual friend.
Yes. And slowly but surely, we started to talk about the ideas that we had for creating an indoor cycling business. I like this about this place, but I think this could be better. Or wouldn't it be great if you could do some upper body work in the 45 minutes? Or could you imagine if
we had a reservation system?
Right. Or it was a, you know, a chic environment. Mm-hmm. Or all the teachers spoke the same language, so you didn't go to, you know, Joe's class at 10 in the morning and it was boot camp, and,
right,
you know, Bill's class at 10 o'clock in the evening and it was, you know, Zen cycle. We always say it was the best blind date we ever went on.
Have you looked at some studies that show the benefits of group exercise versus exercising on your own, for example?
If you drew a chart, you would probably see that the workout for a group of people is more consistent than one person working out by themselves. If you are out there on the West Side Highway running by yourself, on a low day you might run a little slower, and on a fast day you might run a little faster, but probably you are working at a pretty hard level if you are in a class at SoulCycle, because the group is going to carry you with them.
Incidentally, indoor cycling classes take place in the dark. Where did that come from?
For us, we do ride in candlelight, and it sort of sets the tone of a respectful room, a place where people you know, are there for the right reasons. We have this site on our page on our site called Soul Etiquette, which is just about, you know, how we treat each other. I mean, we really treat it as a sanctuary.
I noticed the music plays such a prominent role. Can you talk a little bit about the music and really, you know, there's a DJ component to it?
Absolutely. Our instructors spend a lot of time creating their playlists. You know, there's a musical arc that follows the emotional arc, that follows the physical arc.
We have a place on the site where we put our 10 favorite songs of the month. We went through a real phase, and I think it's a classic. We'll always love the Alicia Keys and Empire State of Mind.
It's Alicia Keys and Jay-Z.
I'm Jessica Harris. You're listening to From Scratch. My guests are Elizabeth Cutler and Julie Rice, co-founders of SoulCycle, a group of indoor cycling studios in New York City, the Hamptons, and Los Angeles. So I want to switch to the nuts and bolts of how you started your business. So you had this excellent first date where you said, okay, I want to get started. So what were the first steps that you took?
Elizabeth started looking for spaces.
We were combing Manhattan. We weren't coming up with much. I mean, people don't really want to rent to, especially at that time in 2006, to people who have no track record whatsoever. So we managed to find a sublet in the back of a lobby on 72nd Street, very well located on Craigslist. And we thought there was going to be a sign. And then just as we went to go sign the lease, they said, oh, I'm very sorry, but you don't have a sign and you're never going to have one. And if you would like to have one, it'll be inside the lobby on your door. So we did a lot of guerrilla marketing. We got a rickshaw, which we painted. We painted it silver and yellow, which are two colors that we use. And we parked it out in front of the studio and locked it up, hoping that it wouldn't get stolen or ticketed. And we'd say, oh, should we spend another $65 on the ticket for this night so that people know where we are?
Well, we literally used to get a ticket every day from the community board for parking our rickshaw outside. And we parked out there for a long time until finally the community board wanted to actually see us.
And then it got stolen. It was sort of a happy accident.
And how long did it take you from your first meeting to opening the doors on the first day?
4 months.
Yeah. Quick. After our first meeting, Elizabeth started looking for space immediately. And, you know, we didn't even know each other very well. So I was still working at my full-time job. And we would sort of talk in the morning and make our separate to-do lists. And I would schedule my lunch break. So, you know, I was representing models at the time. And, you know, I would sort of be creating shampoo deals and stuff. And then during lunch, I would meet the towel guy downstairs. We really just sat down and made a list. Things you need for cycling: water, bikes, shoes, a space. Elizabeth went to IKEA and created most of our first studio out of IKEA cabinetry. Our front desk and our original studio is from good old IKEA.
And Elizabeth, you were also an investor in the beverage company Izzy, which was ultimately sold to Pepsi. How did you come to be one of the early investors in Izzy?
My best friend from college and her husband, who I grew up down the street from, happened to get married, and they started this company after their first daughter was born. We had seen it in Colorado, and, you know, I said to my husband, I said, well, I think we should put some money in it. And I called Todd, and he said, I cannot take your money. I'm going to lose it. I really cannot do this. And I said, okay, I completely understand, but I'm an adult, and if you change your mind, let me know. And 2 days later, he called, and he said, we just got a huge order from Whole Foods. It's our first big order, and we have no money to fill the order, so we will be glad to take your check. And then it was really just a really amazing, happy coincidence. I mean, we had the money to do what we needed to do. Sort of, it was extremely timely. The business was pretty successful from the beginning, but it just took the pressure off us in terms of, you know, paying back investors.
So were you the sole investor initially for the company?
Yes, I was.
So tell me a little more about the logistics of getting the business off the ground. What are some other kind of surprises that, you know, didn't go the way that you had hoped initially?
Well, we put a lot of time into developing an online reservation system. So we would open the reservation system noon on Mondays. The bikes would open for the week, and you could just sign up for the classes that you wanted. And we got to a point in the business where things got, as we started to add classes to the studio, things got really busy. And so the system would crash at noon on Monday, which is like the last thing in the world that you want to happen because you make people so mad. We really had to work through the technology of that.
We didn't know a lot about soundproofing in the beginning. Or how close people live to a building that you're playing music in.
Did you get complaints from neighbors or?
Oh, neighbors, other tenants, landlords. It was one of those. And it was like we threw every expensive Band-Aid on the ceiling that we could.
Well, we had hired a contractor at the behest of our broker who said he knew about soundproofing because he did porn studios in Midtown. And so we thought, well, these people really know what they're doing. And when it came right down to it, that technology did not work at all. We were so horrified because we thought we were doing good.
I will say on a larger scale, you know, we really, when we created this business, we actually created a very atypical model, which I think for us was probably one of the biggest obstacles in the beginning. New York had not really yet adopted the concept of boutique fitness, meaning a pay-per-class model, a pay-per-class cardio model. It's one of those things where you pay your money, you know, on a monthly membership to a gym, and you can take spin class. And so it's always a throw-in, a gimme. So I would say that for the first, you know, 6 months, a year, I mean, it was just a barrage of phone calls all day where you'd pick up the phone and the person on the other end would say, this is included in my membership. Why would I pay you for something that I already get for free? They were sort of outraged, actually.
You should tell that story about your father.
Oh, well, I remember showing my dad the first studio, and he walked in and he looked around and he looked for the showers and he couldn't find them. And he came a couple months after we'd been open, and he looked at me and he said, people really come here? And I said, yeah, people really come here, and the people that come here really like it. And I could just see him looking at my mother. Desperately afraid that we were not going to be able to send our child to college. The real truth is that they're a room with bikes in them.
And you showed him.
Sort of.
He's impressed now. He is impressed. It's very sweet to see how proud he is of Julie.
Given that this was, to some extent, a lifestyle change for both of you, given that you both had five-month-olds, did you have ambition to open up more than one studio, or did kind of success just create the inertia to get you to expansion mode?
Well, in the beginning, we thought if we had one great studio, that was...
Or maybe three.
But. That was really... I mean, but we really, you know, we had a certain number of riders, and we thought, oh my goodness, if we could get 50 people here every day, this would just be it. Imagine the feeling of the first morning that, you know, we opened the door and there was a full class. I mean, I can vividly remember the feeling of the first person that did not get a bike in a class.
And when did that happen?
I mean, that was maybe three or 4 or 5 months in.
Was there a catalyst? Meaning, what were those turning points, either in people or press, that really helped escalate your success?
Well, it's funny that you say that, because when we first opened the studio, I lived across the street. My husband and my daughter and I lived in a tiny rent-controlled apartment that we were busting at the seams growing out of. But on Sundays, I would, you know, sort of, you know, feed Phoebe her bottle and then say, oops, got to go put the garbage out. Tomorrow morning, the garbage guys are coming, you know, or maybe they left the candles burning from the last class. I should go check. I mean, it was that kind of a hands-on. We did everything. And I remember that when our first articles would come out, I would say to Elizabeth, the New York Times is coming out tomorrow. I'm going to get to the studio at 5 a.m. because I can imagine what the phone calls are going to be like, you know. Beg my husband, can you watch the baby this morning? And we would sit there. And maybe if we got one or two phone calls the whole day. I mean, it was no more or no less than any other day at SoulCycle in the beginning. We had a perfect storm sort of a little bit into our business, and this is kind of what it was. The viral marketing started to pick up, and people started to come. And people
really brought their friends. I mean, it was like that commercial, the hair commercial. And the,
you know, I told a friend, and they told
two
friends.
And so on. And it really was like that.
Then a bunch of press did come out, and then we opened a studio in Bridgehampton. So many people go out to vacation out in the Hamptons in the summer, and we thought it would be a really great way to spread the word. And it was really that fall, after that summer, that our business really started to pop.
And any kind of one celebrity that happened to come in that caused kind of a wave effect?
It was Bill Clinton. We did a fundraiser when Hillary was running for president, and we decided to raise money for Hillary's campaign. And it was
through a rider.
It was through a rider, and she helped us to get President Clinton there.
He didn't ride,
but he came and he spoke about
healthcare.
And then we did a ride with what we assumed would have been his favorite songs if he had actually rode the bike. you know what? It was a slow news day. And everyone came. There was nothing else going on in the world except that President Clinton was speaking at SoulCycle. And I remember, and this was great, we called a company that did billboards on Fifth Avenue, and we begged them to stay up all night and make a wrap for the front doors of SoulCycle because we had no sign. And we knew that news crews would be outside wanting to shoot President Clinton going in because nobody could get inside the event. And so we had them create a facade that covered the entire doors so that when you pulled it open, it was a big wheel. Mm-hmm. And sure enough, I mean, our logo made it all over the news. It was on Entertainment Tonight, and it was on the New York Times and the Daily News. And it was really a big, big thing for us.
Yeah. Thank you both very much for joining us.
Thank you. Thank you, Jessica.
Nice to be here.
My guests have been Elizabeth Cutler and Julie Rice, co-founders of SoulCycle. If you'd like to learn more about the show, please visit our website at fromscratchradio.org or follow us on Twitter at Jess G. Harris or find us on Facebook. I'm Jessica Harris. This is From Scratch.